Behind the steering wheel, after he switched on the engine, but before he put the car in gear, Roy allowed himself to withdraw the color snapshot from his wallet. He had carried it with him for more than a year, and he had studied it often. Indeed, it had such power to mesmerize him that he could have spent half the day staring at it in dreamy contemplation. The photo was of the woman who had most recently called herself Valerie Ann Keene. She was attractive by anyone's standards, perhaps even as attractive as Guinevere. What made her special, however, what filled Roy with reverence for the divine power that had created humankind, was her perfect eyes. They were more arresting and compelling than even the eyes of Captain Harris Decoteau of the Los Angeles Police Department. Dark yet limpid, enormous yet perfectly proportioned to her face, direct yet enigmatic, they were eyes that had seen what lay at the heart of all meaningful mysteries. They were the eyes of a sinless soul, yet somehow also the eyes of a shameless voluptuary, simultaneously coy and direct, eyes to which every deceit was as transparent as glass, filled with spirituality and sexuality and a complete understanding of destiny. He was confident that in reality her eyes would be more, not less, powerful than they were in the snapshot. He had seen other photographs of her, as well as numerous videotapes, and each image had battered his heart more punishingly than the one before it. When he found her, he would kill her for the agency and for Thomas Summerton, and for all those well-meaning others who labored to make this a better country and a better world. She had earned no mercy. Except for her single perfect feature, she was an evil woman. But after Roy had fulfilled his duty, he would take her eyes. He deserved them. For too brief a time, those enchanting eyes would bring him desperately needed solace in a world that was sometimes too cruel and cold to bear, even for someone with an attitude as positive as that which he cultivated. By the time Spencer was able to make it to the front door of the apartment with Rocky in his arms, the dog might not have left under his own power, Theda filled a plastic bag with the remaining 10 chocolate chip cookies from the plate beside the armchair, and she insisted that he take them. She also toddled into the kitchen and returned with a homemade blueberry muffin in a small brown paper bag, and then made another trip to bring him 2 slices of lemon coconut cake in a Tupperware container. Spencer protested only the cake because he wouldn't be able to return the container to her.
"Nonsense," she said. "You don't need to return it. I've got enough Tupperware to last 2 lifetimes. For years I collected and collected it because you can keep just anything in Tupperware. It has so many uses. But enough is enough, and I have more than enough. So just enjoy the cake and throw the container away. Enjoy."
In addition to all the edible treats, Spencer had acquired 2 pieces of information about Hannah Valerie. The first was Theda's story about the portrait of the cockroach on the wall of Hannah's bedroom, but he still didn't know what to make of that. The second concerned something that Theda remembered Hannah saying during idle dinner conversation one evening shortly before packing up her things and dusting Vegas off her heels. They had been discussing places in which they had always dreamed of living, and although Theda couldn't make up her mind between Hawaii and England, Hannah had been adamant that only the small coastal town of Carmel, California, had all the peace and beauty that anyone could ever desire. Spencer supposed that Carmel was a long shot, but at the moment it was the best lead he had. On one hand, she hadn't gone straight there from Las Vegas. She had stopped in the Los Angeles metropolitan area and tried to make a life as Valerie Keene. On the other hand, perhaps now, after her mysterious enemies had found her twice in large cities, she would decide to see if they could locate her as easily in a far smaller community. Theda had not informed the band of loud, rude, window-shattering nitwits about Hannah's mention of Carmel. Maybe that gave Spencer an advantage. He was loath to leave her alone with the memories of her beloved husband, long-mourned children, and vanished friend. Nevertheless, thanking her effusively, he stepped across the threshold onto the balcony and walked to the stairs that led down into the courtyard. The mottled gray-black sky and the blustery wind surprised him, for when he had been in Theta world, he had all but forgotten that anything else existed beyond its walls. The crowns of the palms still thrashed, and the air was chiller than before. Carrying a 70-pound dog, a plastic bag full of cookies, a blueberry muffin in a paper sack, and a Tupperware container heavy with cake, he found the stairs precarious. He lugged Rocky all the way to the bottom, however, because he was certain that the dog would race straight back to Theta World if put down on the balcony. When Spencer finally released the mutt, Rocky turned and gazed longingly up the stairs toward that little piece of canine heaven. "Time to plunge back into reality," Spencer said. The dog whined. Spencer walked toward the front of the complex under the wind-whipped trees. Halfway past the swimming pool, he looked back. Rocky was still at the stairs. "Hey, pal," Rocky looked at him. "Whose hound are you, anyway?" An expression of doggy guilt overcame the mutt, and at last he patted toward Spencer.
"Lassie would never leave Timmy, even for God's own grandmother."
Rocky sneezed, sneezed, and sneezed again at the pungent scent of chlorine.
"What if," Spencer said as the dog caught up with him, "I'd been trapped here under an overturned tractor, unable to save myself, or maybe cornered by an angry bear?"
Rocky whined as if in apology.
"Accepted," Spencer said.
On the street in the Explorer again, Spencer said,
"Actually, I'm proud of you, pal."
Rocky cocked his head. Starting the engine, Spencer said,
"You're getting to be more sociable every day. If I didn't know better, I'd think you've been raiding my cash supply to buy some high-priced Beverly Hills therapist."
Half a block ahead, a mold green Chevy rounded the corner in a high-speed slide, tires screaming and smoking, and almost rolled like a stock car in a demolition derby. Somehow it stayed on two wheels, accelerated toward them, and shrieked to a stop at the curb on the other side of the street. Spencer assumed the car was driven by a drunk or by a kid hopped up on something stronger than Pepsi, until the doors flew open and four men of a type he recognized too well exploded out of it. They hurried toward the entrance to the apartment house courtyard. Spencer popped the handbrake and shifted into drive. One of the running men spotted him, pointed, shouted. All four of them turned toward the Explorer.
"Better hold tight, pal."
Spencer tramped on the accelerator and the Explorer shot into the street, away from the men toward the corner. He heard gunfire. Chapter 10. A bullet smacked into the tailgate of the Explorer. Another ricocheted off metal with a piercing whine. The fuel tank didn't explode. No glass shattered. No tires blew out. Spencer hung a hard right turn past the coffee shop on the corner, felt the truck lifting, trying to tip over, so he pushed it into a slide instead. Rubber barked against blacktop as the rear tires stuttered sideways across the pavement. Then they were into the side street, out of sight of the gunman, and Spencer accelerated. Rocky, who was afraid of darkness and wind and lightning and cats and being seen at his toilet, among a dauntingly long list of other things, was not in the least frightened by the gunfire or by Spencer's stunt driving. He sat up straight, his claws sunk into the upholstery, swaying with the movement of the truck, panting and grinning. Glancing at the speedometer, Spencer saw that they were doing 65 in a 30-mile-per-hour zone. He accelerated. In the passenger seat, Rocky did something that he had never done before. He began to bob his head up and down, as if encouraging Spencer to greater speed.
"Yes, yes, yes, yes. This is serious stuff," Spencer reminded him.
Rocky chuffed, as though scoffing at the danger.
"They must have been running audio surveillance on Theta's apartment."
"Yes, yes, 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 yes. Wasting precious resources monitoring Theta. And ever since last November, what the hell do they want with Valerie? What's so damned important that it's worth all this?" Spencer looked at the rearview mirror. 1.5 blocks behind them, the Chevy rounded the corner at the coffee shop. He had wanted to get 2 blocks away before swinging left out of sight, hoping that the trigger-happy torpedoes in the mold-green sedan would be deceived into thinking that he had turned at the first cross street rather than the second. Now they were on to him again. The Chevy was closing the distance between them, and it was a hell of a lot faster than it looked. A souped-up street rod disguised as one of the stripped-down wheezemobiles that the government assigned to Agriculture Department inspectors and agents of the Bureau of Dental Floss Management. Though in their sights, Spencer hung a left at the end of the second block as planned. This time he entered the new street in a wide turn to avoid another time-wasting, tire-stressing slide. Nevertheless, he was going so fast that he spooked the driver of an approaching Honda. The guy wheeled hard right, bounced up onto the sidewalk, grazed a fire hydrant, and rammed a sagging chain-link fence that surrounded an abandoned service station. From the corner of his eye, Spencer saw Rocky leaning against the passenger door, pushed there by centrifugal force, yet bobbing his head enthusiastically.
"Yes, yes, 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 yes."
Pillowy hammers of cold wind buffeted the Explorer. From out of several empty acres on the right, dense clouds of sand churned into the street. Vegas had grown haphazardly across the floor of a vast desert valley, and even most of the developed sectors of the city embraced big expanses of barren land. At a glance, they seemed to be only enormous vacant lots, but in fact they were manifestations of the brooding desert, which was just biding its time. When the wind blew hard enough, the encircled desert angrily flung off its thin disguise, storming into the surrounding neighborhoods. Half-blinded by the seething tempest of sand, with shatters of dust hissing across the windshield, Spencer prayed for more wind, more clouds of grit. He wanted to vanish like a ghost ship disappearing into a fog. He glanced at the rearview mirror. Behind him, visibility was limited to 10 or 15 feet. He started to accelerate, but reconsidered. Already he was plunging into the dry blizzard at suicidal speed. The street was no more visible ahead than it was behind. If he encountered a stopped or slow-moving vehicle, or if he suddenly crossed an intersection against the flow of traffic, the least of his worries would be the 4 homicidal men in the supercharged Fed wagon. One day, when the axis of the Earth shifted just the tiniest fraction of a degree, or when the jet streams of the upper troposphere suddenly deepened and accelerated for reasons mysterious, the wind and desert would no doubt conspire to tumble Vegas into ruin and bury the remains beneath billions of cubic yards of dry, white, triumphant sand. Maybe that moment had arrived. Something thumped into the back end of the Explorer, jolting Spencer. The rearview mirror, the Chevy, on his ass. The Fed wagon receded a few feet into the swirling sand, then leaped forward again, tapping the truck. Maybe trying to make him spin out, maybe just letting him know they were there. He was aware of Rocky looking at him, so he looked at Rocky. The dog seemed to be saying, "Okay, now what?" They passed the last of the undeveloped land and exploded into a silent clarity of sandless air. In the cold, steely light of the pending storm, they had to abandon all hope of slipping away like Lawrence of Arabia into the swirling silicate cloaks of the desert. An intersection lay half a block ahead. The signal light was red. The flow of traffic was against him. He kept his foot on the accelerator, praying for a gap in the passing traffic, but at the last moment he rammed the brake pedal to the floor to avoid colliding with a bus. The Explorer seemed to lift onto its front wheels, then rocked to a halt in a shallow drainage swale that marked the brink of the intersection. Rocky yelped, lost his grip on the upholstery, and slid into the leg space in front of his seat under the dashboard. Belching pale blue fumes, the bus trundled past in the nearest of the 4 traffic lanes. Rocky eeled around in the cramped leg space and grinned up at Spencer. "Stay there, pal. It's safer." Ignoring the advice, the dog scrambled onto the seat again as Spencer accelerated into traffic in the reeking wake of the bus. As Spencer turned right and swung around the bus, the rearview mirror captured the mold-green sedan bouncing across the same shallow swale in the pavement and arcing right into the street as smoothly as if it were airborne. "That son of a bitch knows how to drive." Behind him, the Chevy appeared around the side of the city bus. It was coming fast. Spencer was less concerned about losing them than about being shot at again before he could get away. It would have to be crazy to open fire from a moving car in traffic where stray bullets could kill uninvolved motorists or pedestrians. This wasn't Chicago in the roaring 20s, wasn't Beirut or Belfast, wasn't even Los Angeles, for God's sake. On the other hand, they hadn't hesitated to blast away at him on the street in front of Theda Davidowitz's apartment building. Shot at him. No questions first. No polite reading of his constitutional rights. Hell, they hadn't even made a serious effort to confirm that he was, in fact, the person they believed him to be. They wanted him badly enough to risk killing the wrong man. They seemed convinced that he'd learned something of staggering importance about Valerie, and that he must be terminated. In truth, he knew less about the woman's past than he knew about Rocky's. If they ran him down in traffic and shot him, they would flash real or fake ID from one federal agency or another, and no one would hold them responsible for murder. They would claim that Spencer had been a fugitive, armed and dangerous, a cop killer. No doubt they'd be able to produce a warrant for his arrest, issued after the fact and post-dated, and they would clamp his dead hand around a drop gun that would be linked to a series of unsolved homicides. He accelerated through a yellow traffic light as it turned red. The Chevy stayed close behind him. If they didn't kill him on the spot but wounded him and took him alive, they would probably haul him away to a soundproofed room and use creative methods of interrogation. His protestations of ignorance would not be believed, and they would kill him slowly, by degrees, in a vain attempt to extract secrets that he didn't possess. He had no gun of his own. He had only his hands, his training, and a dog. "We're in big trouble," he told Rocky. In the cozy kitchen of the cabin in the Malibu Canyon, Roy Miro sat alone at the dining table, sorting through 40 photographs. His men had found them in a shoebox on the top shelf in the bedroom closet. 39 of the pictures were loose, and the 40th was in an envelope. 6 of the loose snapshots were of a dog, mixed breed, tan and black, with 1 floppy ear. It was most likely the pet for which Grant had bought the musical rubber bone from the mail-order firm that still kept his name and address on file 2 years later. 33 of the remaining photographs were of the same woman. In some, she appeared to be as young as 20, in others as old as her early 30s. Here, wearing blue jeans and a reindeer sweater, decorating a Christmas tree. And here, in a simple summer dress and white shoes, holding a white purse, smiling at the camera, dappled in sun and shadow, standing by a tree that was dripping clusters of white flowers. In more than a few, she was grooming horses, riding horses, or feeding apples to them. Something about her haunted Roy, but he couldn't understand why she so affected him. She was an undeniably attractive woman, but she was far from drop-dead gorgeous. Though shapely, blonde, blue-eyed, she nonetheless lacked any single transcendent feature that would have put her in the pantheon of true beauty. Her smile was the only truly striking thing about her. It was the most consistent element of her appearance from one snapshot to the next. Warm, open, easy, a charming smile that never seemed to be false, that revealed a gentle heart. A smile, however, was not a feature. That was especially true in this woman's case, for her lips weren't particularly luscious, as were Melissa Wickland's lips. Nothing about the set or width of her mouth, the contours of her philtrum, or the shape of her teeth was even intriguing, let alone electrifying. Her smile was greater than the sum of its parts, like the dazzling reflection of sunlight on the otherwise unremarkable surface of a pond. He could find nothing about her that he yearned to possess, yet she haunted him. Though he doubted that he had ever met her, he felt that he ought to know who she was. Somewhere he had seen her before. Staring at her face, at her radiant smile, he sensed a terrible presence hovering over her just beyond the frame of the photograph. A cold darkness was descending, of which she was unaware. The newest of the photographs were at least 20 years old, and many were surely 3 decades out of the darkroom tray. The colors of even the more recent shots were faded. The older ones held only the faintest suggestions of color, were mostly gray and white, and were slightly yellowed in places. Roy turned each photo over, hoping to find a few identifying words on the reverse, but the backs were all blank, not even a single name or date. 2 of the pictures showed her with a young boy. Roy was so mystified by his strong response to the woman's face and so fixated on figuring out why she seemed familiar that he did not at first realize that the boy was Spencer Grant. When he made the connection, he put the 2 snapshots side by side on the table. It was Grant in the days before he had sustained his scar. In his case, more than with most people, the face of the man reflected the child he had been. He was about 6 or 7 years old in the first photo, a skinny kid in swimming trunks, dripping wet, standing by the edge of a pool. The woman was in a one-piece bathing suit beside him, playing a silly practical joke for the camera, 1 hand behind Grant's head, 2 of her fingers secretly raised and spread to make it appear as though he had a small pair of horns or antennae. In the second photograph, the woman and the boy were sitting at a picnic table. The kid was 1 or 2 older than in the first picture, wearing jeans, a T-shirt, and a baseball cap. She had 1 arm around him, pulling him against her side, knocking his cap askew. In both snapshots, the woman's smile was as radiant as in all those without the boy, but her face was also brightened by affection and love. Roy felt confident that he'd found Spencer Grant's mother. He remained baffled, however, as to why the woman was familiar to him, eerily familiar. The longer he stared at the pictures of her, with or without the boy at her side, the more certain he became that he knew her, and that the context in which he had previously seen her was deeply disturbing, dark, and strange. He turned his attention again to the snapshot in which the mother and son stood beside the swimming pool. In the background, at some distance, was a large barn. Even in the faded photograph, traces of red paint were visible on its high blank walls. The woman, the boy, the barn. On a deep subconscious level, a memory must have stirred, for suddenly the skin prickled across Roy's scalp. The woman, the boy, the barn. A chill quivered through him. He looked up from the photographs on the kitchen table, at the window above the sink, at the crowded grove of trees beyond the window, at the meager coins of noontime sunlight tumbling through the wealth of shadows, and he willed memory to glimmer forth as well from the eucalyptic dark. The woman, the boy, the barn. For all his straining, enlightenment eluded him, although another chill walked through his bones. The barn. Through residential streets of stucco homes where cacti and yucca plants and hardy olive trees were featured in low-maintenance desert landscaping, through a shopping center parking lot, through an industrial area, through the maze of a self-storage yard filled with corrugated steel sheds, off the pavement and through a sprawling park where the fronds of the palms tossed and lashed in a frenzied welcome to the oncoming storm, Spencer sought without success to shake off the pursuing Chevrolet. Sooner or later, they were going to cross the path of a police patrol. As soon as one unit of local cops became involved, Spencer would find it even more difficult to get away. Disoriented by the twisting route taken to elude his pursuers, Spencer was surprised to be flashing past one of the newest resort hotels on the right. Las Vegas Boulevard South was only a few hundred yards ahead. The traffic light was red, but he decided to bet everything that it would change by the time he got there. The Chevy remained close behind him. If he stopped, the bastards would be out of their car and all over the Explorer, bristling with more guns than a porcupine had quills. 300 yards to the intersection. 250. The signal was still red. Cross traffic wasn't as heavy as it could get farther north along the strip, but it was not light either. Running out of time, Spencer slowed slightly, enough to allow himself more maneuverability at the time of decision, but not enough to encourage the driver of the Chevy to try to pull alongside him. 100 yards, 75, 50. Lady Luck wasn't with him. He was still playing the green, but red kept turning up. A gasoline tanker truck was approaching the intersection from the left, taking advantage of the rare chance to make a little speed on the strip, going faster than the legal limit. Rocky began bobbing his head up and down again. Finally, the driver of the tanker saw the Explorer coming and tried to brake quickly without jackknifing.
"All right, okay, okay, gonna make it," Spencer heard himself saying, almost chanting, as if he were crazily determined to shape reality with positive thought. Never lie to the dog.
"We're in deep shit, pal," he amended as he curved into the intersection in a wide arc around the front of the oncoming truck. As panic shifted his perceptions into slow-mo, Spencer saw the tanker sweep toward them, the giant tires rolling and bouncing and rolling and bouncing, while the terrified driver adroitly pumped the brakes as much as he dared. And now it was not merely approaching, but looming over them, huge, an inexorable and inescapable behemoth. Far bigger than it had seemed only a split second ago, and now bigger still, towering, immense. Good God, it seemed bigger than a jumbo jet, and he was nothing but a bug on the runway. The Explorer began to cant to starboard, as if it would tip over, and Spencer corrected with a slight pull to the right and a tap of the brakes. The energy of the aborted rollover was channeled into a slide, however, and the back end traveled sideways with a shriek of tormented tires. The steering wheel spun back and forth through his sweat-dampened hands. The Explorer was out of control, and the gasoline tanker was on top of them, as large as God, but at least they were sliding in the right direction, away from the big rig, although probably not fast enough to escape it. Then the 16-wheel monster shrieked by with only inches to spare, a curved wall of polished steel passing in a mirrored blur, in a gale of wind that Spencer was certain he could feel even through the tightly closed windows. The Explorer spun 360 degrees, then kept going for another 90. It shuddered to a halt, facing the opposite direction and on the far side of the divided boulevard from the gasoline tanker, even as that behemoth was still passing it. The southbound traffic, into the lanes of which Spencer had careened, stopped before running him down, although not without a chorus of screaming brakes and blaring horns. Rocky was on the floor again. Spencer didn't know if the dog had been thrown off the seat again or, in a sudden attack of prudence, had scrambled down there. He said, "Stay," even as Rocky clambered up onto the seat. The roar of an engine. From the left, coming across the broad intersection, the Chevy, hurtling past the back of the halted tanker toward the side of the Explorer. He jammed his foot down hard on the accelerator. The tires spun, then rubber got a bite of pavement. The Explorer bulleted south on the boulevard, just as the Chevy shot past the rear bumper. With a cold squeal, metal kissed metal. Gunshots erupted. 3 or 4 rounds, none seemed to strike the Explorer. Rocky remained on the seat, panting, claws dug in, determined to hold fast this time. Spencer was headed out of Vegas, which was both good and bad. It was good because as he proceeded farther south toward the open desert and the last entrance to Interstate 15, the risk of being brought to a stop by a traffic jam would quickly diminish. It was bad, however, because beyond the forest of hotels, the barren land would provide few easy routes of escape and even fewer places to hide. Out on the vast panoramas of the Mojave, the thugs in the Chevy could slip a mile or two behind and still keep a watch on him. Nevertheless, leaving town was the only sane choice. The turmoil at the intersection behind him was sure to bring the cops. As he was speeding past the newest hotel casino in town, which included a 200-acre amusement park, Spaceport Vegas, his only sane choice became no real choice at all. From across the boulevard, 100 yards ahead, a northbound car swung out of the oncoming traffic, jumped the far side of the low median strip, smashed through a row of shrubs, and bounced into the southbound lanes. It slid to a stop at an angle, blocking the way, ready to ram Spencer if he tried to squeeze around either end of it. He stopped 30 yards from the blockade. The new car was a Chrysler, but otherwise so like the Chevy that the two might have been born of the same factory. The driver stayed behind the wheel of the Chrysler, but the other doors opened. Big, troublesome-looking men got out. The rearview mirror revealed what he'd expected. The Chevy also had halted at an angle across the boulevard 15 yards behind him. Men were getting out of that vehicle, too. And they had guns. In front of him, the men at the Chrysler had guns, too. Somehow that didn't come as a surprise. The final picture had been kept in a white envelope which had been fastened shut with a length of Scotch tape. Because of the shape and thinness of the object, Roy knew that it was another photograph before he opened the envelope, although it was larger than a snapshot. As he peeled off the tape, he expected to find a 5x7 studio portrait of the mother, a memento of special importance to Grant. It was a black-and-white studio photograph, sure enough, but it was of a man in his early 30s. For a strange moment, for Roy, there was neither a eucalyptus grove beyond the windows nor a window through which to see it. The kitchen itself faded from his awareness until nothing existed except him and that single picture, to which he related even more powerfully than to the photos of the woman. He could breathe but shallowly. If anyone had entered the room to ask a question, he could not have spoken. He felt detached from reality, as if in a fever. But he was not feverish. Indeed, he was cold, though not uncomfortably so. It was the cold of a watchful chameleon, pretending to be stone on a stone on an autumn morning. It was a cold that invigorated, that focused his entire consciousness, that contracted the gears of his mind and allowed his thoughts to spin without friction. His heart didn't race as it would have in a fever. Indeed, his pulse rate declined until it was as ponderously slow as that of a sleeper. And throughout his body, each beat reverberated like a recording of a cathedral bell played at quarter speed, protracted, solemn, heavy tolling. Obviously, the shot had been taken by a talented professional under studio conditions, with much attention to the lighting and to the selection of the ideal lens. The subject, wearing a white shirt open at the throat and a leather jacket, was presented from the waist up, posed against a white wall, arms folded across his chest. He was strikingly handsome, with thick, dark hair combed straight back from his forehead. The publicity photograph of a type usually associated with young actors was a blatant glamour shot, but a good one, because the subject possessed natural glamour, an aura of mystery and drama that the photographer didn't have to create with bravura technique. The portrait was a study in light and shadow, with more of the latter than the former. Peculiar shadows cast by objects beyond the frame appeared to swarm across the wall, drawn to the man as night itself was drawn across the evening sky by the terrible weight of the sinking sun. His direct and piercing stare, the firm set of his mouth, his aristocratic features, and even his deceptively casual posture, seemed to reveal a man who had never known self-doubt, depression, or fear. He was more than merely confident and self-possessed. In the photo, he projected a subtle but unmistakable arrogance. His expression seemed to say that, without exception, he regarded all other members of the human race with amusement and contempt. Yet he remained enormously appealing, as though his intelligence and experience had earned him the right to feel superior. Studying the photograph, Roy sensed that here was a man who would make an interesting, unpredictable, entertaining friend. Peering out from his shadows, this singular individual had an animal magnetism that made his expression of contempt seem inoffensive. Indeed, an air of arrogance seemed right for him, just as any lion must walk with feline arrogance if it was to seem at all like a lion. Gradually, the spell cast by the photograph diminished in power, but didn't altogether fade. The kitchen reestablished itself from the mists of Roy's fixation, as did the window and the eucalyptuses. He knew this man. He had seen him before. A long time ago. Familiarity was part of the reason that the picture affected him so strongly. As with the woman, however, Roy was unable to put a name to the face or to recall the circumstances under which he had seen this person previously. He wished the photographer had allowed more light to reach his subject's face, but the shadow seemed to love the dark-eyed man. Roy placed that photo on the kitchen table beside the snapshot of the mother and her son at poolside. The woman, the boy, the barn in the background, the man in the shadows. At a full stop on Las Vegas Boulevard South, confronted by armed men in front of and behind him, Spencer pounded the horn, pulled the wheel hard to the right, and tramped on the accelerator. The Explorer rocketed toward the amusement park, Spaceport Vegas, pressing him and Rocky against their seats as if they were astronauts moonward bound. The cocksure boldness of the gunmen proved that they were feds of some kind, even if they used fake credentials to conceal their true identity. They would never ambush him on a major street before witnesses unless they were confident of pulling rank on local cops. On the sidewalk in front of Spaceport Vegas, on their way from casino to casino, pedestrians scattered, and the Explorer shot into a driveway posted for buses only, though no buses were in sight. Perhaps because of the February cold snap and the pending storm, or maybe because it was only noon, Spaceport Vegas wasn't open. The ticket booths were shuttered, and the thrill rides that were high enough to be seen behind the park walls were in suspended animation. Nevertheless, neon and futuristic applications of fiber optics throbbed and flashed along the perimeter wall, which was 9 feet high and painted like the armored hull of a starfighter. A photosensitive cell must have switched on the lights, mistaking the midday gloom of the advancing storm for the onset of evening. Spencer drove between two rocket-shaped ticket booths toward a 12-foot diameter tunnel of polished steel that penetrated the park walls. In blue neon, the words "Time Tunnel to Spaceport Vegas" promised more escape than he needed. He flew up the gentle ramp, never tapping the brakes, and raced unheeding through time. The massive pipe was 200 feet long. Tubes of brilliant blue neon curved up the walls across the ceiling. They blinked in rapid sequence from the entrance to the exit, creating an illusion of a funnel of lightning. Under ordinary circumstances, patrons were conveyed into the park on lumbering trams, but the half-blinding surges of light were more effective at greater speed. Spencer's eyes throbbed, and he could almost believe that he had been catapulted into a distant era. Rocky was doing the head-bobbing bit again. "Never knew I had a dog," Spencer said, "with a need for speed." He fled into the far reaches of the park, where the lights had not been activated like those on the wall and in the tunnel. The deserted and seemingly endless midway rose and fell, narrowed and widened and narrowed again, and repeatedly looped back on itself. Spaceport Vegas featured corkscrew roller coasters, dive bombers, scramblers, whips, and the other usual gut-churners, all tricked up with lavish science fiction facades, gimmicks, and names. Lights led to Ganymede, hyperspace hammer, solar radiation hell, asteroid collision, devolution drop. The park also offered elaborate flight simulator adventures and virtual reality experiences in buildings of futuristic or bizarrely alien architecture. Planet of the Snake Men, Blood Moon, Vortex Blaster, Death World. At Robot Wars, homicidal machines with red eyes guarded the entrance, and the portal to Star Monster looked like a glistening orifice at one end or the other of an extraterrestrial leviathan's digestive tract. Under the bleak sky, swept by cold wind, with the gray pre-storm light sucking the color out of everything, the future, as imagined by the creators of Spaceport Vegas, was unremittingly hostile. Curiously, that made it appear more realistic to Spencer, more like a true vision and less like an amusement park than its designers ever intended. Alien, machine, and human predators were everywhere on the prowl. Cosmic disasters loomed at every turn. The exploding sun, comet strike, time snap, the Big Bang, wasteland. The end of time was on the same avenue of the Midway that offered an adventure called Extinction. It was possible to look at the ominous attractions and believe that this grim future, in its mood if not its specifics, was sufficiently terrifying to be one that contemporary society might make for itself. In search of a service exit, Spencer drove recklessly along the winding promenades, weaving among the attractions. He repeatedly glimpsed the Chevy and the Chrysler between the rides and the exotic structures, though never dangerously close. They were like sharks cruising in the distance. Each time he spotted them, he whipped out of sight into another branch of the Midway maze. Around the corner from the galactic prison, past the Palace of the Parasites, beyond a screen of ficus trees and a red-flowering oleander hedge that were surely drab compared to the shrubs that grew on the planets of the Crab Nebula, he found a two-lane service road that marked the back of the park. He followed it. To his left were the trees, aligned 20 feet on center, with a 6-foot-high hedge between the trunks. On his right, instead of the neon-lit wall that was featured in the public portions of the perimeter, a chain-link fence rose 10 feet high, topped with coils of barbed wire, and beyond it lay a sward of desert scrub. He rounded a corner, and 100 yards ahead was a pipe and chain-link gate on wheels, controlled by overhead hydraulic arms. It would roll out of the way at the touch of the right remote control device, which Spencer didn't possess. He increased speed. He'd have to ram the gate. Reverting to his customary prudence, the dog scrambled off the passenger seat and curled in the leg space before he could be thrown there by the oncoming impact. "Neurotic, but not stupid," Spencer said approvingly. He was more than halfway to the gate when he caught a flicker of motion out of the corner of his left eye. The Chrysler erupted from between two ficus trees, tearing the hell out of the oleander hedge, and crashed into the service way in showers of green leaves and red flowers. It crossed Spencer's wake and rammed the fence so hard that the chain link billowed as if made of cloth to the end of the lane. The Explorer trailed that billow by a split second and hit the gate with enough force to crumple the hood without popping it open, to make Spencer's restraining harness tighten painfully across his chest, to knock the breath out of him, to clack his teeth together, to make his luggage rattle under the restraining net in the cargo area, but not hard enough to take out the gate. That barrier was torqued, sagging, half-collapsed, trailing tangles of barbed wire like dreadlocks, but still intact. He shifted gears and shot backward as if he were a cannonball returning to the barrel in a counterclockwise world. The hitmen in the Chrysler were opening the doors, getting out, drawing their guns, until they saw the truck reversing toward them. They reversed too, scrambling inside the car, pulling the doors shut. He rammed backward into the sedan, and the collision was loud enough to convince him that he'd overdone it, disabled the Explorer. When he shifted into drive, however, the truck sprang forward. No tires were flat or obstructed by crumpled fenders. No windows had shattered. No smell of gasoline, so the tank wasn't ruptured. The battered Explorer rattled, clinked, ticked, and creaked, but it moved with power and grace. The second impact took down the gate. The truck clambered over the fallen chain link away from Spaceport Vegas into an enormous plot of desert scrub on which no one had yet built a theme park, a hotel, a casino, or a parking lot. Engaging the four-wheel drive, Spencer angled west, away from the strip, toward Interstate 15. He remembered Rocky and glanced down at the leg space in front of the passenger seat. The dog was curled up, with his eyes squeezed shut, as if anticipating another collision. "It's okay, pal." Rocky continued to grimace in anticipation of disaster. "Trust me." Rocky opened his eyes and returned to his seat, where the vinyl upholstery had been well scratched and punctured by his claws. They rocked and rolled across the eroded and barren land to the base of the superhighway. A steep slope of gravel and shale rose 30 or 40 feet to the east-west lanes. Even if he could find a break in the guardrail above him, no escape could be found, and certainly no salvation, on that highway. The people who were seeking him would establish checkpoints in both directions. After a brief hesitation, he turned south, following the base of the elevated interstate. From the east, across the white sand and the pink-gray slate, came the mold-green Chevrolet. It was like a heat mirage, although the day was cool. The low dunes and shallow washes would defeat it. The Explorer was made for overland travel. The Chevrolet was not. Spencer came to a waterless riverbed, which the interstate crossed on a low concrete bridge. He drove into that declivity onto a soft bed of silt where driftwood slept and where dead tumbleweeds moved as ceaselessly as strange shadows in a bad dream. He followed the dry wash under the interstate, west into the inhospitable Mojave. The forbidding sky, as hard and dark as sarcophagus granite, hung within inches of the Iron Mountains. Desolate plains rose gradually toward those more sterile elevations, with a steadily decreasing burden of withered mesquite, dry bunchgrass, and cactus. He drove out of the arroyo, but continued to follow it upslope toward distant peaks as bare as ancient bones. The Chevrolet was no longer in sight. Finally, when he was sure that he was far beyond the casual notice of any surveillance teams posted to watch the traffic on the interstate, he turned south and paralleled that highway. Without it as a reference, he would be lost. Whirling dust devils spun across the desert, masking the telltale plumes cast up behind the Explorer. Although no rain yet fell, lightning scored the sky. The shadows of low stone formations leaped, fell back, and leaped again across the alabaster land. Rocky's cloaks of courage had been cast off as the Explorer's speed had fallen. He was huddled once more in folds of cold timidity. He whined periodically and looked at his master for reassurance. The sky cracked with fissures of fire. Roy Miro pushed the troubling photographs aside and set up his attaché case computer on the kitchen table in the Malibu cabin. He plugged it into a wall outlet and connected with Mama in Virginia. When Spencer Grant had joined the United States Army as a boy of 18, more than 12 years ago, he must have completed the standard enlistment forms. Among other things, he'd been required to provide information about his schooling, his place of birth, his father's name, his mother's maiden name, and his next of kin. The recruiting officer through whom he had enlisted would have verified that basic information. It would have been verified again at a higher level prior to Grant's induction into the service. If Spencer Grant was a phony identity, the boy would have had considerable difficulty getting into the Army with it. Nevertheless, Roy remained convinced that it was not the name on Grant's original birth certificate, and he was determined to discover what that birth name had been. At Roy's request, Mama accessed the Department of Defense dead files on former Army personnel. She brought Spencer Grant's basic information sheet onto the display screen. According to the data on the VDT, Grant's mother's name, which he had given to the Army, was Jennifer Corinne Porth. The young recruit had listed her as deceased. The father was said to be unknown. Roy blinked in surprise at the screen. Unknown. That was extraordinary. Grant had not simply claimed to be a bastard child, but it implied that his mother's promiscuity had made it impossible to pinpoint the man who had fathered him. Anyone else might have cited a false name, a convenient fictional father, to spare himself and his late mother some embarrassment. Logically, if the father was genuinely unknown, Spencer's last name should have been Porth. Therefore, either his mother borrowed the Grant from a favorite movie star, as Bosley Donner believed she'd done, or she named her son after one of the men in her life, even without being certain that he had fathered the boy. Or the unknown was a lie, and the name Spencer Grant was just another false identity, perhaps the first of many, that this phantom had manufactured for himself. At the time of Grant's enlistment, with his mother already dead and his father unknown, he had given his next of kin as Ethel Marie and George Daniel Porth, grandparents. They had been his mother's parents since Porth was also her maiden name. Roy noticed that the address for Ethel and George Porth in San Francisco had been the same as Grant's current address at the time that he'd enlisted. Apparently, the grandparents had taken him in subsequent to the death of his mother, whenever that had been. If anyone knew the true story of Grant's provenance and the source of his scar, it would be Ethel and George Porth. Assuming that they actually existed and were not just names on a form that a recruitment officer had failed to verify 12 years ago, Roy asked for a printout of the pertinent portion of Grant's service file. Even with what seemed to be a good lead in the Porths, Roy wasn't confident of learning anything in San Francisco that would give more substance to this elusive phantom whom he'd first glimpsed less than 48 hours ago in the rainy night in Santa Monica. Having erased himself entirely from all utility company records, from property tax rolls, and even from the Internal Revenue Service files, why had Grant allowed his name to remain in the DMV, Social Security Administration, LAPD, and military files? He had tampered with those records to the extent of replacing his true address with a series of phony addresses, but he could have entirely eliminated them. He had the knowledge and the skill to do so. Therefore, he must have maintained a presence in some data banks for a purpose. Roy felt that somehow he was playing into Grant's hands even by trying to track him down. Frustrated, he turned his attention once more to the two most affecting of the 40 photographs. The woman, the boy, and the barn in the background. The man in the shadows. On all sides of the explorer lay sand as white as powdered bones, ash-gray volcanic rock, and slopes of shale shattered by millions of years of heat, cold, and quaking earth. The few plants were crisp and bristly. Except for the dust and vegetation stirred by the wind, the only movement was the creeping and slithering of scorpions, spiders, scarabs, poisonous snakes, and the other cold-blooded or bloodless creatures that thrived in that arid wasteland. Silvery quills and nibs of lightning flashed continually, and fast-moving thunderheads as black as ink wrote a promise of rain across the sky. The bellies of the clouds hung heavy. With great crashes of thunder, the storm struggled to create itself. Captured between the dead earth and tumultuous heavens, Spencer paralleled the distant interstate highway as much as possible. He detoured only when the contours of the land required compromise. Rocky sat with head bowed, gazing at his paws rather than at the stormy day. His flanks quivered as currents of fear flowed through him like electricity through a closed circuit. On another day, in a different place and in a different storm, Spencer would have kept up a steady line of patter to soothe the dog. Now, however, he was in a mood that darkened with the sky, and he was able to focus only on his own turmoil. For the woman, he had walked away from his life, such as it was. He had left behind the quiet comfort of the cabin, the beauty of the eucalyptus grove, the peace of the canyon, and most likely he would never be able to return to that. He had made a target of himself and had put his precious anonymity in jeopardy. He regretted none of that, because he still had the hope of gaining a real life with some kind of meaning and purpose. Although he had wanted to help the woman, he had also wanted to help himself. But the stakes suddenly had been raised. Death and disclosure were not the only risks he was going to have to take if he continued to involve himself in Valerie Keene's problems. Sooner or later, he was going to have to kill someone. They would give him no choice. After escaping the assault on the bungalow in Santa Monica on Wednesday night, he had avoided thinking about the most disturbing implications of the SWAT team's extreme violence. Now he recalled the gunfire directed at imagined targets inside the dark house, and the rounds fired at him as he had scaled the property wall. That was not merely the response of a few edgy law enforcement officers intimidated by their quarry. It was a criminally excessive use of force, evidence of an agency out of control and arrogantly confident that it wasn't accountable for any atrocities it committed. A short while ago, he had encountered equivalent arrogance in the reckless behavior of the men who harried him out of Las Vegas. He thought about Louis Lee in that elegant office under China Dream. The restaurateur had said that governments, when big enough, often ceased to play by the codes of justice under which they were established. All governments, even democracies, maintained control by the threat of violence and imprisonment. When that threat was divorced from the rule of law, however, even if with the best of intentions, there was a fearfully thin line between a federal agent and a thug. If Spencer located Valerie and learned why she was on the run, helping her would not be simply a matter of dipping into his cash reserves and finding the best attorney to represent her. Naively, that had been his nebulous plan on those few occasions when he had bothered to think about what he might do if he tracked her down. But the ruthlessness of these enemies ruled out a solution in any court of law. Faced with the choice of violence or flight, he would always choose to flee and risk a bullet in the back, at least when no life but his own was at stake. When he eventually took responsibility for this woman's life, however, he could not expect her to turn her own back on a gun. Sooner or later, he would have to meet the violence of those men with violence of his own. Brooding about that, Spencer drove south between the too solid desert and the amorphous sky. The distant highway was only barely visible to the east, and no clear path lay before him. Out of the west came rain in blinding cataracts of rare ferocity for the Mojave, a towering gray tide behind which the desert began to disappear. Spencer could smell the rain, even though it hadn't reached them yet. It was a cold, wet, ozone-tainted scent, refreshing at first, but then strange and profoundly chilling. "It's not that I'm worried about being able to kill someone if it comes to that," he told the huddled dog. The gray wall rushed toward them faster by the second, and it seemed to be more than mere rain that loomed. It was the future, too, and it was all that he feared knowing about the past. "I've done it before. I can do it again if I have to." Over the rumble of the explorer's engine, he could hear the rain now, like a million pounding hearts. "And if some son of a bitch deserves killing, I can do him and feel no guilt, no remorse. Sometimes it's right, it's justice. I don't have a problem with that." The rain swept over them, billowing like a magician's scarves, bringing sorcerous change. The pale land darkened dramatically with the first splash. In the peculiar storm light, the desiccated vegetation, more brown than green, suddenly became glossy, verdant. In seconds, withered leaves and grass appeared to swell into plump tropical forms, though it was all illusion. Switching on the windshield wiper, shifting the Explorer into four-wheel drive, Spencer said, "What worries me, what scares me, is maybe I waste some son of a bitch who deserves it, some piece of walking garbage, and this time I like it." The downpour could have been no less cataclysmic than that which had launched Noah upon the flood, and the fierce drumming of rain on the truck was deafening. The storm-cowed dog probably could not hear his master above the roar, yet Spencer used Rocky's presence as an excuse to acknowledge a truth that he preferred not to hear, speaking aloud because he might lie if he spoke only to himself. "I never liked it before, never felt like a hero for doing it, but it didn't sicken me, either. I didn't puke or lose any sleep over it. So what if the next time, or the time after that?" Beneath the glowering thunderheads in the velvet-heavy shrouds of rain, the early afternoon had grown as dark as twilight. Driving out of murk into mystery, he switched on the headlights, surprised to find that both had survived the impact with the amusement park gate. Rain fell straight to the earth in such tremendous tonnage that it dissolved and washed away the wind that had previously stirred the desert into sand spouts. They came to a 10-foot-deep wash with gently sloping walls. In the headlight beams, a stream of silvery water a foot wide and a few inches deep glimmered along the center of that depression. Spencer crossed the 20-foot-wide arroyo to higher ground on the far side. As the explorer crested the second bank, a series of massive lightning bolts blazed across the desert, accompanied by crashes of thunder that vibrated through the truck. The rain came down even harder than before, harder than he had ever seen it fall. Driving with one hand, Spencer stroked Rocky's head. The dog was too frightened to look up or to lean into the consoling hand. They went no more than 50 yards from the first arroyo when Spencer saw the earth moving ahead of them. It rolled sinuously as though swarms of giant serpents were traveling just below the surface of the desert. By the time he braked to a full stop, the headlights revealed a less fanciful but no less frightening explanation. The earth wasn't moving, but a swift, muddy river was churning from west to east along the gently sloping plain, blocking travel to the south. The depths of this new arroyo were mostly hidden. The racing water was already within a few inches of its banks.